scarcity and resource plenty. Ours, I'm nodding in confirmation. Fossil fuels all the way up to annular fusion-fission cycles, DT lithiumization, so on and so forth. All on a real superficial type level, since Watson's basically got like a little liquid-filled nubbin at the top of his spine where his brain ought to be.
Texas Watson does not overwhelm with brightness, it is true.
But Duchette's got himself convinced he's got this insurmagulate conceptual block that keeps him from grasping annulation, even superficially.
After we converse, will you conduct me to Micturate, please?
It's the same sort of block some people get with the mean value theorem, or in optics when we get to color fields. At a certain level of abstraction, it's like the brain recoils.
Causing pain of impact within the skull, resulting in clutching the head.
Watson's gone the extra click with him. Watson's good-hearted, if nothing else. He's tried flashcards, demonic rhymes, even claymation film strips from over at Rind Latin Remedial.
You are saying without avail.
I'm saying apparently the bookster just sits there in class, eyes bugging out, stomach in fucking knots, dope slapped by anxiety. I'm saying frozen.
You are saying recoiling.
The right side of his face frozen in this anxiety tick, envisioning any possible tennis career as with these little wings on it, flying off. Talking all kinds of crazy self-injuring, anxious depression talk. It all started with him and Mario and me in the sauna, him breaking down. Me and Mario trying to talk him out of the crazy washed-up-at-15 type depressed talk. Mario exploiting a previous, like, therapeutic bond with the kid from about the mole. Then with me putting DT annulation in broad stroke terms, a freaking invertebrate could have understood, for Christ's sake. Just about passing out from the sauna all through this. Finally taking him into Lyle, even with the 18 still doing circuits in there. Lyle's working with the booger now. Between the anxiety and the marathon sauna time, it's a real feeding frenzy for old Lyle, let me tell you.
I too confess experiences of anxiety for annulation with Tex Watson. Though I am trivially 13 and not yet required to grapple in hard science.
Mario in the sauna kept telling Duchette to just imagine somebody doing somersaults with one hand nailed to the ground, which, what the fuck is that? And lo and surprise, didn't help the booger a whole lot.
Did not part the veil of Maya.
Didn't do jack.
Annular energy circles are intensively abstract, my home nation believes.
But my old message to Boog was that DT cycles aren't all that fucking hard if you don't paralyze your brain with Career with Wings brain cartoons. The extra-hot breedering and lithiumization stuff gets hairy, but the whole fusion-fission waste-annulation thing in toto you can't imagine as nothing but a huge right triangle.
You are presaging to give the thumbnail lecture.
Commit this one simple model to your little Pakistani ram cells, and you'll tap dance right through Watson's kitty physics and up into optics, which is where the abstracto-conceptual fur really flies, kid, let me tell you.
I am one of the seldom of my home nation whose talents are weak in science, unhappily.
This is why God also gave you quick hands and a wicked lob off the backhand, though. Just picture a kind of massive, pseudo-cartographic right triangle. You got your central, impregnantly guarded ONAN, Sunstrand, waste-intensive, fusion facility up in what used to be Montpelier, in what used to be Vermont in the concavity. From Montpelier, the process's wastes piped to two sites, one of which is that blue glow up at night by the Methuen fan complex, just south of the concavity, right flush up against the wall, and checkpoint Pongo,
which our tall and sleep-depriving fans in our area point at to blow away from the south.
Roger that. Where the Toxo fusion's wastes plutonium fluorides refined into plutonium-239 and uranium-238, and fissioned in a standard, if somewhat hot and risky, breeder system. Much of the output of which is waste-239, which gets piped, or catapulted, or long shiny trucked, way up to what used to be Loring AFB. Air Force Base, near what used to be Presque Isle, Maine, where it's allowed to decay naturally into Neptunium-239 and then Plutonium-239 and then added to the UF sub-4 fractional waste, also piped up from Montpelier, then fissioned in a purposely ugly way, in such a way as to create, like, hellacious amounts of highly poisonous radioactive wastes, which are mixed with heavy water and specially heated zirconium, piped through specially heavily guarded heated zirconium pipes back down to Montpelier as raw material for the massive poisons needed for toxic lithiumization and waste intenseness and annular fusion.
My head is spinning on its axis.
Just a moving right triangular circle of interdependence and waste creation and utilization, see? And when are we going to get you out on the old eschaton map for a little geopolitical sparring, Ars? What with those hands and wicked lob? Incidentally, the arrhythmic meaty whacking sounds is Booger hitting himself in the thigh and chest in there, which self-abuse is a textbook symptom of an anxiously depressed episode.
With this, I can create sympathy. For, confusingly to me, fusion produces no waste. This we are taught in the science of my home nation. This is the very essence of the promise of the attraction of fusion for a densely populous and waste-impacted nation such as mine. We are taught fusion to be self-sufficient and wasteless perpetuation. Alas, my need to visit the lavatory is becoming distended.
But except no, although this was the very roadblock that stymified annihilation and what had to be overcome and was overcome, though in a way so unintuitive and abstracto-conceptual that this is where your third-world educational systems really sadly in need of, like, a massive, up-to-date textbook airlift or something. It's also at just this point in the fusion, wastelessness problem where our own glorious optical founder, Inks, Ex-da, Mrs. Inks, poor I know who you refer. The man himself, at just this point, makes his final lasting contribution to state science after he quit designing neutron diffusion reflectors for defense. You've seen the copper light plaque in Tavis's office. This is from the AEC for the Inkster's da's, like, lasting contribution to the energy of waste.
The purpose for which I was upon the stairs and became disoriented, was to visit a lavatory. This was long ago.
Hold your water, 1 second is all this'll take. You wouldn't even fucking be here without Inks Dye, you know? What the guy did was he helped design these special holographic conversions so the team that worked on annihilation could study the behavior of subatomics in highly poisonous environments without getting poisoned themselves.
They thus are studying holographic conversions of the poisons instead of the poisons.
Men's sanity and corporate sterno are like an optical glove box, the ultimate prophylactic.
Please conduct me.
Like, but for instance, did your nation know that the whole annular theory behind a type of fusion that can produce waste that's fuel for a process whose waste is fuel for the fusion? The whole theory behind the physics of it comes out of medicine?
This means what? A bottle of medicine?
The study of medicine, Ars. Your part of the world takes annular medicine for granted now. But the whole idea of treating cancer by giving the cancer cells themselves cancer was anathematic just a couple decades back.
Anathematic?
As in, like, radical, fringe, wacko, laughed out of town on a rail by, quote, mainstream established science, whose idea of treatment was to, like, poison the whole body and see what was left. Though annular chemotherapy did start out kind of wacko. You can see these early micro photos, Shock's got that poster of, that he won't take down even after you're sick of it. The early micro photos of cancer cells getting force-fed micro-massive quantities of overdone beef and diet soda, forced to chain-smoke micro-sized Marlboros. Near tiny little cellular phones.
I am standing first upon one foot and then upon another foot.
Except, and corollarying out of the micro-medical mode, was this equally radical idea that maybe you could achieve a high-waste annihilating fusion by bombarding highly toxic radioactive particles with massive doses of stuff even more toxic than the radioactive particles. A fusion that feeds on poisons and produces relatively stable plutonium fluoride and uranium tetrafluoride. All you turn out to need is access to mind-staggering volumes of toxic material.
Therefore, placing the natural fusion site in the Great Concavity.
Roger and Yawul. Here, things get abstractly furry, and I'll just skim through the fact that the only kertwang in the whole process, environmentally, is that the resultant fusion turns out so greedily efficient that it sucks every last toxin and poison out of the surrounding ecosystem. All inhibitors to organic growth for hundreds of radical clicks in every direction.
Hence the eastern concavity of anxiety and myth.
You end up with a surrounding environment so fertily lush, it's practically unlivable.
A rainforest of steroidic anoids.
Close enough.
Therefore, rapacious feral hamsters, an insect of Volkswagen size, an infantile giganticism, and the unmacheteable regions of forest of the mythic eastern concavity.
Yes, ours. And you find you need to keep steadily dumping in toxins to keep the uninhibited ecosystem from spreading and overrunning more ecologically stable areas, exhausting the atmosphere's poisons so that everything hyperventilates, and thus and such. So this is why EWD's major catapulting is from the metro area due north.
Into the eastern concavity, keeping it at bay.
See how it all comes together?
Mr. Thorpe will evince keen disappointment if I resort to removing my blindfold to locate a lavatory.
Ars, I hear you. I hear fine. You don't need to go on and on. The thing to keep in mind for, if you have to take Watson, is the cyclic effects of the waste delivery and fusion. Major catapulting is on what days?
The dates which are in each month prime numbers, until midnight.
Which eradicates the overgrowth until the toxins are fused and utilized. The satellite scenario is that the eastern part of Grid 3 goes from overgrown to wasteland to overgrown several times a month, with the first week of the month being especially barren and the last week being like nothing on Earth.
As if time itself were vastly sped up. As if nature itself had desperately to visit the lavatory.
Accelerated phenomena, which is actually equivalent to an incredible slowing down of time. The mnemonic rhyme Watson tried to get the Boog to remember here is wasteland to lush, time's in no rush.
Decelerated time. I have got you.
And this is what the Boog's saying is eating him alive the worst, conceptually. He says he's toast if he can't wrap his head around the concept of time in flux, conceptually. It jacklights him for the whole annular model overall. Granted, it's abstract, but you should see him. One half of the face is like spasming around, while the other half of the mole just hangs there, staring like a bunny you're about to run over. Lyle's trying to walk him real slowly through the most basic kitty physical principles of the relativity of time in extreme organic environments. In between Booger's trips back to the sauna, the irony for the Booger Man is you don't really even have to know that much about temporal flux stuff, since Watson's forehead gets all mottled and pruny-looking when he thinks about it himself.
Do not please necessitate begging from me, Idris Arslanian.
The eastern concavity, of course, being a whole different kettle of colored horses from what Ink calls the barren eleotical wastes of the western concavity, let me tell you.
I will let you tell me anything, as long as this is told to me over the porcelain of a lavatory.
Interesting step you're doing here, Id, I'd have to say.
I beg without frequency. My home culture views begging as low caste.
Ars, I'm standing here thinking we could work something out, maybe.
I commit no illegal or degrading acts, but I will, if forced, beg.
Forget that. I'm just thinking. You're Muslimic, isn't that right?
Devoutly. I pray 5 times daily in the prescribed fashion. I eschew representational art and carnality in all its 4,404 forms and guises.
Body a temple and such like?
I eschew. Neither stimulants nor depressing compounds pass my lips, as is prescribed in the holy teachings of my faith.
I'm wondering, if you had any specific plans for this urine you're so anxious to get rid of ours, then?
I am not following.
What say we hash it all out over some porcelain, then, brother?
Mike Pamulus, you are in motion a prince, and in repose a sage.
Brother, it'll be a cold day in a warm climate when this kid right here is in repose. It was strange upon strange. It was almost as if the legless and pathologically shy punting groupies were somehow afraid of Moment's Juno-esque Ms. Steepley. Orin had seen his last wheelchair the day before she came up, and now he realized, driving, it was only hours after she'd left that they were now back, with their shy ruses. The excitement, hope, acquisition, contempt cycle of seduction always left Orin stunned and wrung out, and not at his quickest on the uptake. It was only after he'd cleaned up and dressed and exchanged the standard compliments and assurances, taken the elevator's glass pod down the tall hotel's round glass core into the lobby, gone out through the pressurized revolving door into the scalp-crackling gust of Phoenix heat, waited for the car's directional AC to render the steering wheel touchable, and then injected himself into the teeming arteries of Route 85 and Bell Road West, back out toward Sun City, ruminating as he drove, that it ker-twanged on him that the handicapped man at the hotel's room's door had had a wheelchair, that it was the first wheelchair he'd seen since Hal had hit him with his theory, and that the legless surveyor had, stranger, the same Swiss accent as the hand model. En route, R. Lentz's mouth writhes, and he scratches at the little rhinophemic rash and sniffs terribly and complains of terrible late autumn leaf mold allergies, forgetting that Bruce Green knows all too well what coke hydrolysis's symptoms are from having done so many lines himself, back when life with M. Bonk was one big party. Lentz details how the vegetarian new Joelle girl's veil is because of this condition people get where she's got only one eye that's right in the middle of her forehead, from birth, like a seahorse, and asks Green not even to think of asking how he knows this fact. While Green acts as lookout while Lentz relieves himself against a Market Street dumpster, Lentz swears Green to secrecy about how poor old scarred-up diseased Charlotte Treat had sworn him to secrecy about her secret dream in sobriety, was to someday get her GED and become a dental hygienist, specializing in educating youngsters pathologically frightened of dental anesthesia, because her dream was to help youngsters, and but how she feared her virus has placed her secret dream forever out of reach. All the way up the spurs Harvard Street toward Union Square, in a barely northwest vector, Lentz consumes several minutes and less than 20 breaths, sharing with Green some painful family of origin issues about how Lentz's mother, Mrs. Lentz, a thrice divorcee and data processor, was so unspeakably obese she had to make her own muumuus out of brocade drapes and cotton tablecloths, and never once did come to Parents' Day at Bishop Anthony McDiartima Elementary School in Fall River, Massachusetts, because of the parents had to sit in the youngsters' little liftable desktop desks during the Parents' Day presentations and skits. And the one time Mrs. L. hove her way down to BAMES for Parents' Day and tried to seat herself at little Randall L.'s desk between Mrs. Lamb and Mrs. LaRue, she broke the desk into kindling and needed four stocky cranberry farmer dads and a textbook dolly to arise back up from the classroom floor, and never went back, fabricating thin excuses of busyness with data processing and basic disinterest in Randall L.'s schoolwork. Lentz shares how then, in adolescence, his mother died because one day she was riding a Greyhound bus from Fall River, Massachusetts, north to Quincy, Massachusetts, to visit her son in a Commonwealth Youth Corrections facility Lentz was doing research for a possible screenplay in. And during the voyage on the bus, she had to go potty. And she was in the bus's tiny potty in the rear of the bus, going about her private business of going potty, as she later testified. And even though it was the height of winter, she had the little window of the potty wide open, for reasons Lentz predicts Green doesn't want to hear about, on the northbound bus, and how this was one of the last years of unsubsidized, ordinational year dating, and the final fiscal year that actual maintenance work had ever been done on the infamous 6-lane commuter-ravaged Commonwealth Route 24 from Fall River to Boston's South Shore by the pre-ONANite Governor Claprude's Commonwealth Highway Authority. And the Greyhound bus encountered a poorly marked under-construction area where 24 was all stripped down to the dimple-ironed sheeting below, and was tooth-rattlingly striated and chuckled and torn up, and just in general, basically a mess. And the poorly marked and unflagmanned debris, plus the excessive speed of the northbound bus, made it jounce god-awfully, the bus, and swerve violently to and fro, fighting to maintain control of what there was of the road. And passengers were hurled violently from their seats, while, meanwhile, back in the closet-sized rear potty, Mrs. Lentz, right in the process of going potty, was hurled from the toilet by the first swerve and proceeded to do some high-velocity and human waist-flinging pinballing back and forth against the potty's plastic walls. And when the bus finally regained total control and resumed course, Mrs. Lentz had, freakishly enough, ended up her human pinballing with her bare and unspeakably huge backside wedged tight in the open window of the potty, so forcefully ensconced into the receptacle that she was unable to extricate. And the bus continued on its northward sojourn the rest of the way up 24, with Mrs. Lentz's bare backside protruding from the ensconcing window, prompting car horns and derisive oratory from other vehicles. And Mrs. Lentz's plaintive shouts for help were unavailed by the passengers that were arising back up off the floor and rubbing their sore noggins and hearing Mrs. Lentz's mortified screams from behind the potty's locked reinforced plastic door, but were unable to excretate her because the potty's door locked from the interior by sliding across a deadbolt that made the door's outside say, "Occupied, occupado, occupé." And the door was locked, and Mrs. Lentz was wedged beyond the reach of arm length and couldn't reach the deadbolt no matter how plaintively she reached out her mammoth, fat-waddled arm. And, like fully 88% of all clinically obese Americans, Mrs. Lentz was diagnosed clinically claustrophobic and took prescription medication for anxiety and ensconcement phobias. And she ended up successfully filing a 7-figure suit against Greyhound Lines and the almost-defunct Commonwealth Highway Authority for psychiatric trauma, public mortification, and second-degree frostbite, and received such a morbidly obese settlement from the Dukakis-appointed 18th Circus Civil Court that when the check arrived in an extra long-size envelope to accommodate all the zeros, Mrs. L lost all will to data process, or cook or clean, or nurture, or finally even move, simply reclining in a custom-designed 1.5-meter-wide recliner, watching interlaced gothic romances, and consuming mammoth volumes of high-lipid pastry brought on gold trays by a pastry chef she'd had put at her individual 24-hour disposal and outfitted with a cellular beeper, until 4 months after the huge settlement she ruptured and died, her mouth so crammed with peach cobbler the paramedics were hapless to administer CPR, which Lentz says he knows, by the way. CPR. By the time they hit the spur, their northwest tacking has wheeled broadly right to become more truly north. The route down here is a modrion of alleys narrowed to near defiles from all the dumpsters. Lentz goes first, blaze trailing. Lentz gives these sort of smoky looks to every female that passes within eyeshot. Their vector is now mostly north-northwest. They stroll through the rich smell of dryer exhaust from the backside of a laundromat off Dustin and Commonwealth, the city of Metro Boston, Massachusetts at night, the ding and trundle of the B and C greeny trains coming up Comm Ave's hill west, street drunks sitting with their backs to sooted walls, seeming to study their laps, even the mist of their breath discolored, the complex hiss of bus brakes, the jagged shadows distending with headlights passage, Latin music drifting through the Spurs projects, twined around some 5/4 shine stuff from a boombox over off Feeney Park, and in between these, a haunting plasm of Hawaiian-type music that sounds at once top volume and far, far away. The zithery, drifting Polynesian strains make Bruce Green's face spread in a flat mask of psychic pain he doesn't even feel is there. And then, the music's gone. Lentz asks Green what it's like to work with ice all day at Leisure Time Ice, and then himself theorizes on what it must be like, he'll bet, with your crushed ice and ice cubes in pale blue plastic bags with a staple for a twisty and dry ice in wood tubs pouring out white smoke, and then your huge blocks of industrial ice packed in fragrant sawdust. The huge blocks of man-sized ice with flaws way inside like trapped white faces, white flames of internal cracks. Your picks and hatchets and really big tongs, red knuckles and rimed windows, and thin, bitter freezer smell with runny-nosed poles in plaid coats and calpacs. Your older ones with a chronic cant to one side from all the time lugging ice. They crunch through iridescent chunks of what Lentz IDs as a busted windshield. Lentz shares feelings on how between three ex-husbands and feral attorneys and a pastry chef that used pastry dependence to warp and twist her into distorting a testament toward the chef, and Lentz's being through red tape still in Quincy's YCA hold and in a weak litigational vantage, the ruptured Mrs. L's will had left him out in the cold to self-fend by his urban wits, while ex-husbands and patissiers lay on Riviera Beach furniture, fanning themselves with high-denomination currency, about all which Lentz says he grapples with the issues of on a, like, daily basis, leaving Green a gap to make understanding sounds. Green's jacket creaks as he breathes. The windshield glass is in an alley whose fire escapes are hung with what looked like wet frozen tarps. The alley's tight-packed dumpsters and knobless steel doors and the dull black of total grime. The blunt snout of a bus protrudes from the frames of the alley's end, idling. Dumpster's garbage doesn't have just one smell, depending. The urban loom makes the urban night only semi-dark, as in licorice-y, a luminescence just under the skin of the dark, the swelling. Green keeps them updated regarding time. Lentz has begun to refer to Green as brother. Lentz says he has to piss like a racehorse. He says the nice thing about the urban city is that it's one big commode. The way Lentz pronounces brother involves one R. Green moves up to stand in the mouth of the alley, facing out, giving Lentz a little privacy several dumpsters behind. Green stands there in the start of the alley's shadow, in the bus's warm backwash, his elbows out and hands in the jacket's little pockets looking out. It's unclear whether Green knows Lentz is under the influence of Bing. All he feels is a moment of deep wrenching loss, of wishing getting high was still pleasurable for him, so he could get high. This feeling comes and goes all day, every day, still. Green takes a gasper from behind his ear and lights it, and puts a fresh one on deck behind the ear. Union Square, Alston. "Kiss me where it smells," she said, "so I took her to Alston," unquote. Union Square's lights throb. Whenever somebody stops blowing their horn, somebody else starts blowing their horn. There's three Chinese women waiting at a light across the street from the guy with the lobsters. Each of them's got a shopping bag. An old VW bug like Dooning Glynn's VW bug, idling, mufflerless outside Riley's roast beef. Except Dooney's bug's engine is exposed where the back hood got removed to expose the bug's guts. It's like impossible to ever spot a Chinese woman on a Boston street that's under 60 or over 1.5 meters, or not carrying a shopping bag, except never more than one bag. If you close your eyes on a busy urban sidewalk, the sound of everybody's different footwear's footsteps all put together sounds like something getting chewed by something huge and tireless and patient. The searing facts of the case of Bruce Green's natural parents' deaths when he was a toddler are so deeply repressed inside Green that whole strata and substrata of silence and mute dumb animal suffering will have to be strip-mined up and dealt with a day at a time in sobriety for Green to even remember how, on his fifth Xmas Eve in Waltham, Massachusetts, his pop had taken the hydrant-sized little Brucey Green aside and given him, to give his beloved mother for Xmas, a gaily Gauguin-colored can of Polynesian Manaloa brand macadamia nuts. Said cylindrical can of nuts, then toted upstairs by the child, and painstakingly wrapped in so much foil sheen paper that the final wrapped present looked like an oversized dachshund that had required first bludgeoning and then restraint at both ends, with two rolls each of scotch tape and garish fuchsia ribbon to be subdued and wrapped and placed under the gaily lit pine. And even then, the package seemed mushily to struggle as the substrata of paper shifted and settled. Bruce Green's pop, Mr. Green, had, at one time, been one of New England's most influential aerobics instructors, even co-starring once or twice in the decade before digital dissemination on the widely rented Buns of Steel aerobics home video series, and had been in high demand and very influential until, to his horror, in his late 20s, the absolute prime of an aerobics instructor's working life. Either one of Mr. Green's legs began spontaneously to grow, or the other leg began spontaneously to retract, because within weeks, one leg was all of a sudden nearly 6 inches longer than the other. Bruce Green's one unrepressed visual memory of the man is of a man who, progressively and perilously, leaned as he hobbled from specialist to specialist, and had to get outfitted with a specialized orthopedic boot, black as a cauldron, that seemed to be 90% sole, and resembled an asphalt spreader's clunky boot, and weighed several pounds, and looked absurd with spandex leggings. And the long and short of it was that Brucey Green's pop was aerobically washed up by the leg and boot, and had to career change, and went, bitterly, to work for a Waltham Novelty or Notions concern, something with N in the name. Acme Novelty's Notions, or some such, where Mr. Green designed sort of sadistic, practical joke supplies, specializing in the Jolly Jolt hand buzzer and Blammo cigar product lines, with a sideline in entomological ice cubes and artificial dandruff, etc. Demoralizing, sedentary, character-twisting work is what an older child would have been able to understand, peering from his night-lit doorway at an unshaven man who, clunkily, paced away the wee hours on a nightly basis down in the living room, his gait like a bosun's in heavy seas, occasionally breaking into a tiny, tentative gluteal thruster squat and kick, almost falling, muttering bitterly, carrying a Falstaff tall boy. Something touching about a gift that a toddler's so awfully overwrapped makes a sickly pale, a neurasthenic but doting Mrs. Green, Brucey's beloved mama, choose the mugged dachshund foil sheen cylinder present first, of course, to open on Xmas morning, as they sit before the crackling fireplace in different chairs, by different windows, with views of Waltham sleet, with bowls of Xmas snacks, and Acme logoed mugs of cocoa and hazelnut decaf, and watch each other taking turns opening gifts. Brucey's little face aglow in the firelight as the unwrapping of the nuts proceeds through layer and stratum, Mrs. Green a couple times having to use her teeth on the rinds of tape. Finally, the last layer is off, and the gay-colored can in view. Mauna Loa, Mrs. Green's favorite and most decadent special treat food. World's highest calorie food except for, like, pure suet. Nuts so yummy they should be spelled S-I-N, she says. Brucey excitedly bobbing in his chair, spilling coca and gummy bears. A loving toddler. More excited about his gift's receipt than what he's going to get himself. His mother's clasped hands before her sunken bosom. Sighs of delight and protest. And an easy open lid on the can. Which the contents of the macadamia-labeled can is really a coiled cloth snake with an ejaculatory spring. The snake sprongs out as Mrs. G. screams, a hand to her throat. Mr. Green howls with bitterly professional practical gag mirth and clunks over and slaps little Bruce on the back so hard that Brucey expels a lime gummy bear he'd been eating. This, too, a visual memory, contextless and creepy, which arcs across the living room and lands in the fireplace's fire with a green little s aflame. The cloth snake's arc has terminated at the imitation crystal chandelier overhead, where the snake gets caught and hangs with quivering spring as the chandelier swings and tinkles, and Mr. Green's thigh-slapping laughter takes a while to run down, even as Brucey's mama's hand at her delicate throat becomes claw-shaped as she claws at her throat and gurgles and slumps over to starboard with a fatal cardiac, her cyanotic mouth still open in surprise. For the first couple minutes, Mr. Green thinks she's putting them on, and he keeps rating her performance on an Acme interdepartmental 1-8 gag scale until he finally gets pissed off and starts saying she's drawing the gag out too long, that she's going to scare their little Brucie, who's sitting there under the swinging crystal, wide-eyed and silent. And Bruce Green uttered not another out loud word until his last year of grade school, living by then in Winchester with his late mother's sister, a decent but dust-bowly looking Seventh-day Adventist who never once pressed Brucie to speak, probably out of sympathy, probably sympathizing with the searing pain the opaque-eyed child must have felt over not only giving his mama a lethal Xmas present, but over then having to watch his widowed asymmetrical pop cave psycho-spiritually in after the wake, watching Mr. Green pace and clunk around the living room all night, every night after work, and an under-microwaved supper for two in his Frankensteinian boot, clunking around in circles, scratching slowly at his face and arms until he looked less scourged than brambled, and in loosely associated mutters, cursing God and himself and Acme nuts and serpents or whatever, and leaving the fatal snake up hanging from the fake crystal fixture and the fatal Xmas tree up in its little red metal stand until all the strings of lights went out and the strings of popcorn got dark and hard and the stand's bowl of water evaporated so the tree's needles died and fell, brownly, off onto the rest of the still unopened Xmas presents clustered below, one of which was a package of Nebraska corn-fed steaks, whose cherub motif wrapping was beginning ominously to swell. And then finally, the even more searing childhood pain of the public arrest and media scandal and sanity hearing and Midwest trial, as it was established after the fact that the post-Xmas Mr. Green, whose one encouraging sign of holding some tattered remnants of himself together after the funeral had been the fact that he still went faithfully every day to work at Acme Inc., had gone in and packed a totally random case of the company's outgoing Blammo cigars with vengefully lethal tetrol-based high explosives, and a VFW, 3 Rotarians, and 24 Shriners had been grotesquely decapitated across southeastern Ohio before the federal ATF traced the grisly forensic fragments back to B. Green Sr.'s Blammo lab in Waltham. And then the extradition and horribly complex sanity hearing and trial and controversial sentencing. And then the appeals and death watch and lethal injection, Bruce Green's aunt handing out poorly reproduced W. Miller tracts to the crowds outside the Ohio prison as the clock ticked down to injection, little Bruce in tow, blank-faced and watching, the crowd of media and anti-capital activists and Defarge-like picnickers milling and roiling, many T-shirts for sale, and the red-faced men in sport coats and fezzes, oh, their rage-twisted faces, the same red as their fezzes, as the men careened this way and that in their little cars, formations of motorized Shriners buzzing the gates of the ODC maximum facility and shouting, "Burn, baby, burn," or the more timely, "Get lethally injected, baby, get lethally injected." Bruce Green's aunt, with her center-parted hair visibly graying under the pillbox hat and face obscured for 3 Ohio months behind the black mesh veil that fluttered from the pillbox hat, clutching little Bruce's head to her underwired bosom day after day until his blank face was smooshed in on one side. Green's guilt, pain, fear, and self-loathing have, over years of unprescribed medication, been compressed to the igneous point where he now knows only that he compulsively avoids any product or service with "n" in its name, always checks a palm before a handshake, will go blocks out of his way to avoid any parade involving fezzes in little cars, and has this silent, substratified fascination slash horror gestalt about all things even remotely Polynesian. It's probably the distant and attenuated luau music echoing erratically back and forth through angled blocks of Alston cement that causes Bruce Green to wander as if mesmerized out of Union Square and all the way up Comm Ave into Brighton, and up to like the corner of Comm Ave and Brainerd Road, the home of the Unexamined Life nightclub with its tilted, flickering bottle of blue neon over the entrance, before he realizes that Lance is no longer beside him asking the time. That Lance hadn't followed him up the hill even though Green had stood there outside the Union Square alley way longer than anybody could have needed to take a legitimate whiz. He and Lance have become separated, he realizes. Now way southwest of Union, on Comm, Green looks around at traffic and T-tracks and bar patrons and TUL's huge bottles low neon flutter. He wonders whether he's somehow blown Lance off or whether Lance has blown him off. And that's all he wonders. That's the total complexity the speculation assumes. That's his thought for the minute. It's like the whole nut can and cigar traumas drained into some psychic sump at puberty, sank and left only an oily slick that catches the light in distorted ways. The warbly Polynesian music's way clearer up here. He starts up the steep hill on Brainerd Road, which terminates at the infield line. Maybe Lance can't move straightforwardly south at all past a certain time. The acclivity is not kind to asphalt spreader's boots. After the initial crazed gerbil-in-brain phase of early withdrawal and detox, Bruce Green has now returned to his normal psycho-repressed cerebral state, where he has about one fully developed thought every 60 seconds, and then just one at a time, a thought, which materializes already fully developed and sitting there and then melting back away like a languid, liquid crystal display. His in-house counselor, the extremely tough-loving Calvin T., complains that listening to Green is like listening to a faucet with a very slow drip. His rap is that Green seems not serene or detached, but totally shut down, disassociated, and Calvin T. tries weakly to draw Green out by pissing him off. Green's next full thought is the realization that even though the hideous Hawaiian music had sounded like it was drifting up northward from down at the Alston Spur, it's somewhat louder now the farther west he moves toward Enfield's Cambridge Street dogleg and St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Brainerd, between Commonwealth and Cambridge Street, is a sine wave of lung-busting hills through neighborhoods Tiny Yule had described as depressed residential. Unending rows of crammed-together triple-decker houses, with those tiny, sad architectural differences that seem to highlight the essential sameness, with sagging porches and psoriatic paint jobs, or aluminum siding gone carbuncular from violent temperature swings. Yard litter, and dishes, and patchy grass, and fenced pets, and children's toys lying around in discarded attitudes, and eclectic food smells, and wildly different patterned curtains or blinds in a house's different windows, due to these old houses are carved up inside into apartments for, like, alienated BU students, or Canadian and concavity-displaced families, or even more alienated BC students, or, probably, it looks like, the bulk of these leaseholders are Green and Bonk-esque, younger, blue-collar, hard-partying types that have posters of the fiends in human shape, or choosy mothers, or snout, or the bio-available five in the bathroom. And black lights in the bedroom, and oil change stains in the driveway, and that throw their supper dishes into the yard and buy new dishes at Caldor instead of washing their dishes, and that still, in their 20s, ingest substances nightly and use party as a verb, and put their sound system speakers in their apartment's windows facing out, and crank the volume out of sheer high-spirited obnoxiousness because they still have their girlfriends to pound beers with, and do shotguns of dope into the mouth of, and do lines of being off various parts of the naked body of, and still find pounding beers and doing bongs and lines fun, and get to have fun on a nightly after-work basis, cranking the tunes out into the neighborhood air. The street's bare trees are densely limbed. They're a certain type of tree. They look like inverted brooms in the residential dark. Green doesn't know his tree names. The Hawaiian music is what's pulled him southwest, it emerges. It's originating from someplace in this very neighborhood, somewhere around West Brainerd, and Green moves upriver toward what sounds like the source of the sound with a blankly horrified fascination. Most of the yards are fenced in stainless steel chain-link fencing,
and occasional yard dogs whine, or more commonly, bark and snarl and leap, territorially at Green from behind their fences. The fences shivering from the impact, and the chain link stuff dented outward from previous impacts from previous passers-by. The thought that he isn't scared of dogs develops and recedes in Green's midbrain. His jacket creaks with every step. The temperature is steadily dropping. The fenced front yards are the toy and beer can strewn type, where the brown grass grows in uneven tufts, and the leaves haven't been raked and are piled in windblown lines of force along the base of the fence, and unpruned hedges and overfull waste baskets and untwisted trash bags are on the sagging porch because nobody's gotten around to taking them down to the EWD dumpster at the corner. And garbage from the overfull receptacles blows out into the yard and mixes with the leaves along the fence's base. And some gets out into the street and is never picked up and eventually becomes part of the composition of the street. A non-peanut M&M box is like intaglioed into the concrete of the sidewalk under Green. So bleached by the elements, it's turned bone white and is only barely identifiable as a non-peanut M&M box, for instance. And, looking up from identifying the M&M box's make, Green now espies Randy Lentz. Green has happened upon Lentz, way up here on Brainerd, now strolling briskly alone up ahead of Green. Not close, but visible under a functioning streetlight about a block farther uphill on Brainerd. There's some disincentive to call out. The incline on this block isn't bad. It's cold enough now so his breath looks the same whether he's smoking or not. The tall, curved street lamps here looked green, just like the weaponish part of the Martian vessels that fired fatal rays in their conquest of the planet, in an ancient cartridge Tommy Ducey'd never tired of, that he labeled the case War of the Wells. The Hawaiian music dominates the aural landscape by this point now, coming from someplace up near where he sees the back of Lentz's coat. Someone has put Polynesian music speakers in their window pretty clearly. Creepy, slack-key steel guitar balloons across the dim street, booms off the sagging facades opposite. It's Don Ho and the Soul Hoopy Players. The grass skirt and foamy breakers sound that makes Green put his fingers in his ears, while at the same time he moves more urgently toward the Hawaiian music source. A pink or aqua three-decker with a second-floor dormer and red shingled roof, with a blue and white Canucker flag on a pole protruding from a window in the dormer, and Sirius JBL speakers facing outward in the two windows on either side of the flag, with the screens off so you can see the woofers throbbing like brown bellies hula-ing, bathing the 1700 block of West Brainerd in dreadful ukuleles and hollow log percussives. All the blunt fingers in his ears do is add the squeak of Green's pulse and the underwater sound of his respiration to the music, though. Figures in plaid flannel or else floral Hawaiian shirts and those flower necklaces melt in and out of lit view behind and over the window speakers, with the oozing quality of large group chemical fun, and dancing, and social intercoursing. The lit windows make slender rectangles of light out across the yard, which, the yard, is a sty. Something about Randy Lentz's movements up ahead, the high-kneed, tiptoed skulk of a vaudeville fiend up to no good at all, keeps Green from calling out to him, even if he could have made himself heard over what to him is a roar of blood and breath and ho. Lentz moves through the one operative streetlight's cone, across the sidewalk and over to the stainless chain link of the same Canucker house, holding something out to a Shetland-sized dog whose leash is attached to a fluorescent plastic clothesline-y thing by a pulley and can slide. It's cold, and the air is thin and keen, and his fingers are icy in his ears, which ache with cold. Green watches, rapt on levels he doesn't know he has, drawn slowly forward, moving his head from side to side to keep from losing Lentz in the fog of his breath, not calling out, but transfixed. Green and Mildred Bonk, and the other couple they'd shared a trailer with T. Ducey with, had gone through a phase one time where they'd crash various collegiate parties and mix with the upper-scale collegiates. And once, in one February, Green found himself at a Harvard U dorm where they were having a, like, beach theme party, with a dump truck's worth of sand on the common room floor, and everybody with flower necklaces and skin bronzed with cream or UV booth salon visits. All the tow-headed guys in floral untucked shirts walking around with locked-jawed noblesse oblige and drinking drinks with umbrellas in them, or else wearing Speedos with no shirts and not one fucking pimple any place on their back, and pretending to surf on a surfboard somebody had nailed to a hump-shaped wave made of blue and white papier-mâché with a motor inside that made the fake wave sort of undulate. And all the girls in grass skirts oozing around the room trying to hula in a shimmying way that showed their thighs' lipovac scars through the shimmying grass of their skirts. And Mildred Bonk had donned a grass skirt and bikini top out of the pile by the keggers, and even though almost 7 months pregnant, had oozed and shimmied right into the mainstream of the swing of things. But Bruce Green had felt awkward and out of place in his cheap leather jacket and haircut. He'd dyed orange with gasoline in a blackout, and the Eat the Rich patch he'd perversely let Mildred Bonk sew onto the groin of his police pants. And then they'd finally got tired of the Hawaii Five-O theme and started in with the Don Ho and Soul Hoopie CDs. And Green had gotten so uncomfortably fascinated and repelled and paralyzed by the Polynesian tunes that he'd set up a cabana chair right by the kegs and had sat there overworking the pump on the kegs and downing one plastic cup after another of beer foam until he got so blind drunk his sphincter had failed. And he'd not only pissed, but also actually shit his pants for the second time ever and the first public time ever and was mortified with complexly layered shame and had to ease very gingerly into the nearest by head and remove his pants and wipe himself off like a fucking baby, having to shut one eye to make sure which him he saw was him. And then there'd been nothing to do with the fouled police pants but crack the bathroom door and reach a tattooed arm out with the pants and bury them in the living room's sand like a house cat's litter box. And then, of course, what was he supposed to put on if he ever wanted to leave that head or dorm again to get home? So he'd had to hold one eye shut and reach one arm out again and, like, strain to reach the pile of grass skirts and bikini tops and snatch a grass skirt and put it on and slip out of the Hawaiian dorm room at a side door without letting anybody see him. And then ride the red line and see Greeny and then a bus all the way home in February in a cheap leather jacket and asphalt spreader's boots and a grass skirt, the grass of which rode up in the most horrifying way. And he'd spent the next 3 days not leaving the trailer in the spur in a paralyzing depression of unknown etiology, lying on Tommy D's crusty-stained sofa and drinking Southern Comfort straight out of the bottle, and watching Deucey's snakes not move once in 3 days in their tank. And Mildred had given him 2 days of high-volume shit for, first, sulking antisocially by the keg, and then screwing out and abandoning her at 7 months gone to a sandy room full of tanly, anomic blondes who said catty things about her tattoos, and creepy boys who talked without moving their lower jaw, and asked her things like where she summered, and kept offering her advice on no-load funds, and inviting her upstairs to check out their Dewar prints, and saying they found overweight girls terribly compelling and their defiance of cultural ascetic norms. And Bruce Green lay there with a head full of hoopie and unresolved pain, and didn't say a word or even have a fully developed thought for 3 days, and had hidden the grass skirt under the dust ruffle of the couch, and later savagely torn it to shreds and sprinkled the clippings over Deucey's hydroponic marijuana development in the tub for mulch. Lentz goes in and out of Green's focus several times within a dozen andante strides, still out in front of the Canadian refugee-type house that's drawn Green on. Lentz, holding a little can of something up over one side of the fence's gate and dribbling something onto the gate, holding something else that suddenly engages the dog's full attention. For some reason, Green thinks to check his watch. The pink or orange clothesline quivers as the leash's pulley runs along it. As the dog comes up to meet Lance inside the gate he's slowly opened. The huge dog seems neither friendly nor unfriendly toward Lance, but his attention is engaged. The leash and pulley could never hold him if he decided Lance was food. There's bitter-smelling material from his ear on Green's finger, which he can't help but sniff. He's forgotten and left the other finger in his ear. He's not pretty close, standing in a van's shadow just outside the pyramid of sodium light from the streetlight, like two houses down from the source of the grisly sound, which, all of a sudden, is in the silence between cuts of Ho's early, "Don Ho from Hawaii with all my love," so that Green can hear baritone Canadianese party voices through the open windows, and also the low lallations of baby talk of some sort from Lentz. Hooty-ooty-doggy-woggy, and whatnot. Presumably directed at the dog, who's coming over to Lentz in a sort of neutrally cautious but attentive way. Green has no clue what kind of dog it is, but it's big. Green can remember not the sight, but the two very different sounds of the footfalls of his pop, the late Mr. Green, pacing the Waltham living room, the crinkle of the paper bag around the tall boy in his hand. It's well after 22:45 hours. The dog's leash slides, hissing to the end of the day glow line, and stops the dog a couple paces from inside of the gate, where Lance is standing, inclined in the slight forward way of somebody who's talking baby talk to a dog. Green can see that Lance has a slightly gnawed square of Don G's hard, old meatloaf out in front of him, holding it toward the straining dog. Lance has the blankly intent look of a short-haired man with a Geiger counter. The hideously compelling Ho starts again with a total abruptness that makes CD so creepy. Green's got one finger in one ear, shifting around slightly to keep Lentz's lamp shadow from blocking the view. The music balloons and booms. The Nux have turned it way up for "My Lovely Launa Una Luau Lady," a song that's always made Green want to put his head through a window. Part of the instrumentals sound like a harp on acid. The hollow log percussives are like a heart in your extremist type terror. Green fancies he can see windows in the houses opposite vibrate from the horrific vibration. Green's having way more than one thought per minute now, the squeak of the gerbil wheel starting to crank deep inside. The undulating shiver is a slack steel guitar that fills little Brucey's head with white sand and undulating tummies and heads that resemble New Year's subsidized parade balloons. Huge, soft, shiny, baggy, wrinkled, grinning heads, nodding and bobbing as they slowly inflate to the shape of a giant head, tilted forward, straining at the ropes they're pulled by. Green hasn't watched a New Year's parade since the year of the Tuck's medicated pads, which had been obscene. Green's close enough to see that the Hawaiianized Nuck House is 412 West Brainerd. Blue-collar type cars and 4x4s and vans are all up and down the street, packed in a somehow party-ish attitude, as in parked in a hurry, some of them with Canadian lettering on the plates. Flirterly stickers and slogans in Canadian on some of the windows also. An old Montego, cammed out into a slingshot dragster, is parked square in front of 412 in a sort of menacing way, with two wheels up on the curb and a circle of flowers hung jauntily over the antenna, and the ellipses of dull fade in the paint job of the hood that show the engine's been bored out and the hood gets real hot. And Lance has gotten down on one knee and breaks off some of the meatloaf and tosses it, underhand, to the ground inside the leash's range. The dog goes over and lowers its head to the meat. The distinctive sound of Gately's meatloaf getting chewed, plus the ghastly music's zithery, warbling roar. Lentz now rises, and his movements in the yard have a melting and wraith-like quality in the different shades of shadow. The lit window farthest from the limp flag has solid, swarthy guys in beards and loud shirts, passing back and forth snapping their fingers under their elbows with flower-strewn females in tow.